Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout off.
Hello, everybody. It's time for Bilge Pumps 87. So this is the first Bilge Pumps of April, and probably going to be possibly the only Bilge Pumps of April, or at least the only Bilge Pumps for a little while in April, mainly on the grounds that next week, when we should be recording the next one, I will be in the United States of America.
And I'll be responsible for 200 teenagers.
Mm-hmm. And I shall continue to be in the United States of America, all going well, for 3 weeks. So definitely no bilge pumps next week, unfortunately. Possibly bilge pumps the weeks after that, assuming that Dr. Clark and Jamie can scare up some additional guests.
Mm-hmm. We will be doing our level best to do so.
So yeah, that's the plan for the near future. But other than that, here we go for today.
Hello. How are we all doing?
Well, it's just the two of us.
It's just the two of us, but how are we doing? How are you doing? You're preparing for your trip?
I'm preparing for the trip. Good. Everything's currently on schedule, except for messing around with the airline with the tickets for the flight out, which is rather important.
Have you ordered an airstrike on anyone yet?
Not yet, no. At the moment...
Well, then, it's going okay, then.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, this morning has mostly been just waking up very creaky. Because I went to my regularly scheduled airsoft game yesterday, and it was very fun, but the weather was a complete betrayal, because the weather forecast said it was going to be cold, very cold, windy, etc., etc. And so I thought, right, well, it's windy. I've learned my lesson from the last three times I ignored that. I'm not going to bring a sniper rifle this time, because the wind and airsoft sniper rifles don't mix when it's at a high speed. And, you know, when you woke up, it was -4. So the cold bit seemed to be in play as well. And instead, it turned out within the space of about an hour to have gone from -4 to almost pushing double digits, nice and sunny, which, of course, when you're charging around is quite warm, makes you quite warm. And it was practically no wind. So I had left my sniper rifle at home, which was a mistake, because that, you know, that was the thing I could have used the most. But instead I went charging around quite a lot with an AK and a shotgun and various other bits and pieces. And yeah, that was all great until I woke up this morning and realized my legs hurt a lot.
Well, I'm not surprised.
Memo to everybody who doesn't already realize this, but carrying out a bar M1918 by its handle whilst running through and over hilly terrain is not fun.
It's not.
But
it really isn't fun.
Enough about me. What's going on in the world that we need to talk about today?
Well, there's lots of people getting very excited over drones and UAVs again. Mm-hmm. There's lots of people getting very excited over various ship procurements. And lots of people saying, oh, yes, well, because these people are doing this, everyone should do it this way. And you and I, of course, are proponents of the idea that perhaps, well, the world is not a one-size-fits-all scenario. And, well, this is why we sometimes need Jamie, because Jamie reminds us that sometimes these people just say this because they're being stupid. Whereas you and I sometimes actually think they might be willfully just being ignorant. But honestly, what's going on in the world at the moment? So much weird stuff. I mean, seriously, let's take on the current UK procurement debate going on over the British destroyer, Type 45s, upgrading them. There's some debates going on about the Type 83 already, and there's various debates going on about Type 26, Type 31s, and why they haven't been accelerated production, and et cetera, what's going on with Russia, et cetera. And I sit there and go, well, yes, it's a knee-jerk reaction, and I would like to see more money in defence, because, as a big surprise, I think we do need more money in defence. I honestly don't think this should be a shock to any of our listeners. But what The problem I'm worried about is if you're doing a knee-jerk reaction, is if you just pay now, you're probably going out with a program you're going to be cancelling five times. Or it's going to be like Ajax, which came across, started out as a sort of reasonable program, and then it had so many different assessments attached to it that it became absolutely absurd. And when I say absolutely absurd, I mean absurd. It became a scenario where you were honestly looking at Ajax and going, how is this one vehicle going to fulfill all these different requirements? I think there were, was it 1,500 critical or is it essential criteria they had to meet, and possibly another 2,500 critical? It was something absurd in that the two highest levels of you must meet them criteria were both numbered in the thousands, and then the lesser we would like to haves were basically a couple of hundred all combined.
When they could have just got CV90,
yeah,
which already exists, already works, and already comes in almost all the flavors that they wanted, they want out of Ajax.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the old thing, isn't it? Perfect is the enemy of good enough. Yeah. And in an attempt to reach perfect, they've ended up with a vehicle approximately the size of Warrior, which is even less capable than Warrior. And Warrior is supposed to be an IFV, not a scout. Like, literally, mm-hmm. Warrior, with all that space inside it that's dedicated to carrying infantry, would do a better job of pretty much everything they're asking Ajax to do than Ajax.
Yeah.
And it's not exactly like Warrior has been a trouble-free development, to say the least. But at this stage, they will probably literally be better off just, if they're for some reason pathologically obsessed with not buying CV90, they'd probably be better off just looking for a new AFV and a new IFV and just taking all the warriors that are still working and reconfiguring the infantry fighting, the infantry storage space to whatever it is they want out of the various variants. Because at least Warrior moves and its gun works.
And we've got a new gun which works for it as well, which we spent all the money developing and did work.
Mm.
Someone was telling me actually recently, no. The main gun on Ajax works. It's the machine guns which don't work. And you go, so you're telling me the weapon system that's been basically around in very little change since almost World War One in terms of the machine guns the British Army currently uses and are fitted in most of their vehicles in terms of mechanism is not working in your vehicle. Yes. That's kind of like saying you have mucked up how to use a knife and fork. In that, there is a legitimate reason that you can muck up using a knife and fork. There are many, but most of those mean that a lot else has gone wrong before the knife and fork are not working properly.
Mm-hmm.
How did you muck up the machine gun? But, and this is also starting to filter into ship design as well, because the amount of people I see, she goes, well, the thing is, when you consider it, compared to these later, to the laser and the latest electronic weapons, those theorized electronic weapons, lasers, etc., gun-based weapons are incredibly inefficient and manpower-intensive and using your space in comparison. So we shouldn't fit those. And I go, that's fine. Are the laser weapons available yet? No, but they will be in 5 years' time. So we'll tell that if the war breaks out in a year's time, we'll tell everyone on the ships, don't worry. In another 4 years, if everything goes to plan, you will have the weapons to defend yourself. But until then, you're not getting enough guns to do a job because they're inefficient on space in comparison to weapons which don't actually exist in a version you can fit to a ship yet.
It's the same stupid thing that they've got with that the US Navy is suffering with the Zumwalts and with the LCSs in in to varying degrees of building a ship before the systems are ready.
Yeah.
And then hoping, just hoping that they can make the systems work afterwards. And then as soon as something stops working or turns out to be unworkable, you're now left with a ship that's got a significant portion of its offensive systems just flat out not available.
Mm-hmm. It's just, it's absurd. It is really. And some of the stuff they put in, and you go, why? Why are you doing that? What does it, why does that, in what world does this make sense?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of questionable choices at the moment going on in various high-end naval procurement exercises. I mean, like the, well, the simple fact that we've had our defence, well, not full defence budget, but our UK defence spending review this year, which comes after all the shenanigans happening in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
And have they decided to increase spending? Nope. Have they decided? Well, I mean, that covers everything. There's no additional Air Force, Army, or Navy spending.
In the moment you're not increasing spending, nothing is going to happen. But it's one of those things of, I would like to see the funding increase, but it's also, what programs would I like to see added to? If I was going to say, you know, people go, oh, well, we should now be ordering 24 Type 26s. No, but I wouldn't say no to 9 to 12 of them instead of the remaining ones. And I'd build them in the time we're currently churning out the ones we are churning out. And I'd like to opt the Type 31s or maybe bring forward the Type 32 procurement to make sure we know when that's booked in. So that's going to be straight hard on the heels of the Type 31s and they're going to be built quicker. Mm-hmm. That would make a lot of sense to get a steady drumbeat of some ships coming out. But we're not. And the reason we're not is because, let's be honest, at the moment, as devastating as this war is in Ukraine, it's happening to other people. And most of the politicians in Britain are even more insulated than the politicians in the rest of Europe, because the rest of Europe, they're sort of going, well, you know, the Russians could advance, but there's also people looking at the Russians going, well, they're being defeated by Ukraine. You can hear the stories that are going to happen now. People are going to go, oh, well, look at how easily the Russians were beaten by the Ukrainians. It wasn't easy. It's been cost a lot of lives, and keep putting down the Ukrainian army and saying the sort of things you're saying about them by saying it was easy. You know, the Russians went from, the first doctrine was the four-hour war, which failed because Ukraine actually turns out to have a decent military who managed to hold the airport, which the Russians were supposed to seize. Then they went to the three-day encirclement of Kiev. And again, the Ukrainian military managed to do a very good job of holding up the supply convoy. So the three-day, so distance, logistics, managed to impact the Russians, and they can never get back to that one. And now it's been the war of attrition. And let's be honest, that has not been nice. There are thousands of civilians dead, tens, hundreds of thousands potentially, of civilians dead. In judging by some of the photos we're seeing and stuff coming out, reports coming out from eastern Ukraine, in very, what's the academic phrase to use at this current time before we actually have an international court of judgment? So suspicious and different and potentially malvolent circumstances. And yet that's all the other side of Europe and the other side of the English Channel. And you know, some of the debates we have going on, the amount of people who seem to think that what we need to do is rebuild the British Army of the Rhine and stick that in Ukraine. Well, I'd love to, but that would take a very long time and incredibly expensive. And that means you need to start the Royal Navy's aircraft carriers no longer are useful, because what you need is a large army sitting in Ukraine. And you're going, are you really sensibly thinking through this doctrine for Britain? The sensible thing is Britain is going to maintain a large army and stick it in Ukraine.
Well, as If we'd had Professor Lambert on here, I'm sure at this point he would be somewhere in orbit, probably rivaling the ISS, because as he rightly points out, Britain's strategy for being a successful and influential nation does not rely on the army. Sorry, guys, it just doesn't. Or as Admiral Fisher said, the army is a projectile to be fired by the Navy. Britain, we don't have the population base, apart from anything else, to sustain an army in a one-on-one slugging match with anybody of remotely comparable technological size, because pretty much everybody else who approaches our level of technology, or potentially in some fields exceeds it, has a lot more bodies to throw at the problem. Mm. You know, we're a very densely packed island, yes, but we are still a very small island. You know, Russia has more people than we do. Germany and France have more people than we do. America has a lot more people than we do, and China has more people than anyone. So in a land war, numbers count. You know, it doesn't matter how technologically advanced you are to a certain degree, but, you know, if you've only got 10 tanks and you've got a 100-mile wide front, those 10 tanks can only be in so many places at once. And if you try and put one tank every 10 miles, that's not going to end well for you, because you're just going to be completely overwhelmed. And I know that's exaggerating a little bit, but it is still the simple fact, you know, even if the army numbers were boosted back up to, say, 120,000, there's a limited amount you can do to that with that force. Mm-hmm. No matter how good they are, no matter how technologically advanced they are, as I say, you could win every single battle with minimal losses with 120,000 strong army, but in any situation other than the defense of the UK on any continental battlefield, an opponent with four times as many troops can just park some units around you in a holding pattern and then just bypass you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the whole, again, as Professor Lambert would probably happily point out, the whole British Army of the Rhine is a historical aberration for the UK. Having a large, we didn't go into World War I with a large army. The army numbers were cut quite dramatically between the wars, and, you know, Britain has only really had a large army relative to the size of the Navy during the Cold War, and that was mainly because NATO said we had to.
Mm-hmm.
Having a large army doesn't really serve our interests. Having a large army only worked when it was a part of a much larger combined NATO ground force. But, you know, if we're going to be doing combined NATO ground forces, well, you know, back in the day you had West Germany, now Germany is all one piece, and now they're actually being persuaded to rearm, and the Poles were in the Warsaw Pact, and now they're in NATO as well. And I'm sorry, but the Polish and the Germans, and to a lesser extent the French, and possibly even the Italians, although maybe not the Italians so much, are probably in a much better place to provide big chunk of any kind of NATO ground force than Britain is.
Yeah.
Britain is in a much better place to provide air support and naval support, naval logistics support, naval firepower, than it ever is going to be to fight front and center in a land conflict. We can provide decent high quality troops and decent high quality technology, but we shouldn't delude ourselves into thinking that we could have, you know, the third or fourth most powerful army on the planet, because it's completely unsustainable for us.
It's just not what we're going to be about. I'm sorry to people if this bursts your bubble, but that's not really what Britain's capable of doing. It's not.
No, and it comes, again, I think we've made this point before on bilge pumps, it comes down to, what is your unit of force? You know, a unit of force for the Royal Navy, a few hundred people in a Type 45 destroyer, is a major unit of force.
Mm-hmm.
What's the equivalent of a Type 45 destroyer, or a large destroyer like a Burke or something? It's probably a brigade.
Yeah.
Maybe slightly larger, but probably roughly a brigade. And an army brigade is a lot larger than a few hundred people. I'm just trying to remember because I'm not too hot on them. How big is a brigade?
I think a standard British Army brigade is about 7,000, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Typical NATO standard is 3,200 to 5,500. Switzerland and Austria go up to 11,000. So, yeah. So you're talking about probably somewhere between 5,000 and 10,000 men. So,
yeah. Especially, is it, the thing is, what's Chucky has is when you have a brigade which is a part of a division, then you have all the stuff up in the divisional level. When you're sometimes talking about British brigades, they're self-deploying as a brigade. So suddenly they gain all sorts of divisional level assets, get put into the brigade fighting formation, and suddenly it goes up far larger.
Yeah, because we've only got three divisions, I think, at the moment. Frontline.
Administratively.
Yes, possibly less. So, I mean, so a division, but the thing is that so a division, you can probably say army wise, a British division is approximately the same as having a Queen Elizabeth class carrier.
Hmm.
But a division is going to be 15,000-20,000 strong.
Yeah.
So, you know, 15,000 to 20,000 men and all the ancillary food, pay, accommodation, et cetera, et cetera, versus a Queen Elizabeth class carrier, which is going to be 20% of that crew size if you absolutely maxed everything out, and probably 10% of that.
If one depends on high tech, the other one depends on mass as well. Because this is the thing with naval fighting power, it's basically you have a certain limit of things. You have the capabilities you have, which is lovely. Mm-hmm. But if you... How do I put this politely? So, let's say a battleship will cost 800 or so people to build. But the trouble is the defining limitation on your ability to produce ships is your finance, but also the infrastructure you're willing to put for it. The real reason why the Royal Navy and the Kaiserlich Marine were never really going to be in a serious contest. It looked scary at points, but that was mainly because the Royal Navy hadn't been funded and hadn't built enough ships big enough. If it had launched HMS Dreadnought and immediately built her Seven Sisters, along with four Invincibles, which it could have churned out in 2 years. Let's be honest, the Royal Navy could have churned that out between 1905 and 1907 without any trouble at all. Then the rest of the world would be going, oh, sugar, you've got an entire new battle squadron of that new type of battleship, and you've got those cruisers, and all the rest of us are just starting from scratch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so and the thing is, it's both comparisons require a lot of technology, you know. So Queen Elizabeth, up to maybe 1,000 crew, realistically. So to run a Queen Elizabeth as compared to running a division is going to cost less than a tenth of the wage bill of running a division. So you're making there's a fairly big saving there. And yes, the Queen Elizabeth class carrier herself is quite large and quite expensive. But when you consider that, you know, just looking at, say, third division, which is apparently our main battle division in the British Army, there's strike brigades, there's armored infantry brigades, there's artillery, signals, obviously logistics, air defense, it's like the engineers. All of those guys require a lot of high-tech stuff. The air defense guys, you know, they used to have Rapier and Starstreak. They're probably now getting whatever the land-based version of Sea Scepter is.
They have. What do they call? Do they actually just call it Land Scepter now?
Something like that, probably. But yeah,
they'll maintain Starstreak. Yeah.
The logistics guys have got to have all their trucks. Okay, fair enough. And a truck isn't necessarily the most high tech thing, but a military truck that doesn't break down is. The engineers have got to have all the bridging vehicles, the recovery vehicles, the assault engineering vehicles, the anti-mine vehicles, signals. Obviously, there's a lot of high-tech signal equipment, communications, etc., all of which has to be distributed across the entire force because they've got to be able to talk to each other. Artillery, you've got at the moment the AS-90s and various other self-propelled and towed artillery, all of which requires its own technology. And then, of course, the armored infantry and any armored units. They've got to have tanks, they've got to have IFVs, etc. You know, all of that is a lot of very high-tech stuff that costs an awful lot of money. So you can't go around thinking that just because you don't have a big metal box to put everything in, that somehow an army division costs less technology-wise than a carrier does. The only difference is the carrier is almost a lump sum to get the big floaty metal box, whereas a division, you end up paying in bits and pieces for lots of individual things. But ultimately, as I say, at the end of the day, you're still also stuck with an absolutely massive wage bill. And you have this massive collection of various bits and pieces sitting around in various places in the UK that still can't go anywhere unless you build some ships to take them somewhere. You still need the ships anyway.
Ultimately, the problem, whenever I hear an army supposedly army commentators being sort of basically saying we should be spending money on the Navy, I was sort of going, the Navy should be the service you are absolutely screaming support for, because all your ability to get anywhere is dependent upon the Navy getting you there.
It's dependent on the RFA to have the ships, the logistics ships to supply you there and to carry you there, which, you know, that's one factor that which definitely needs boosting. And then for the RFA to get you from point A to point B without being blown out of the water, you need the Royal Navy to protect the RFA.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then of course the question, you know, the question is, do you need to take a massive land force over to somewhere to do all the fighting? If you have a strong enough Navy, you can cut your opponent off and watch them wither on the vine, which has been, again, the historical precedent for British power. So, yeah. You know, and you, when you break it down, it's a similar thing. You break it down on a brigade level. If you've got, you know, high thousands of men in a brigade, and we're comparing that to a Type 45, well, Type 45's only got about just under 200 crew. So, again, the wage bill is a lot less. And, again, yes, the Type 45 is, you know, £1 billion odd, although that's partly because they cut the numbers so the price per ship went up. But, you know, a brigade has all the same issues that a division does, as we just looked at, except it's just on a slightly smaller scale, the same as the Type 45 is on a slightly smaller scale.
Yeah.
You've got vehicles, you've got communications, you've got obviously all the weaponry, etc. All of that costs money, so you're not saving any money really, in terms of technology, by the technology build, by having a land force instead of a sea force. But the thing is, if you look at, I think the way I'd look at it is, you could have 120,000 men in the army, and as we said, that would represent a really nice, really powerful, assuming that they can get something that's not Ajax to, you know, do all these various roles. But anyway, in theory, you can have a really nice, really capable, high technology land force, which will make invading Britain pretty much impossible, which is kind of the point of the army. But realistically, unless we're fighting Falklands 2 or something like that, we're not going to be going on the offensive with the army, and we're not going to be playing a part in any major continental land battles, except as part of a much, much larger alliance where, to be perfectly honest, we're going to be an ancillary to whoever brings the biggest amount of men by a long, 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 long way. So,
to be fair, again, we can be quite useful there, providing a high tech. An armored division is incredibly high. This is one of the things I always support. So a few things which you can do really well with a small population, but you need high technology of investment. An armored division, that's always a good thing to be investing in if you're Britain. And I would seriously think the British armed forces, and in terms of land forces, should be built around maintaining a regular and a reserve armored division, so you can keep an armored division in this field at strength. That would be what I'd be basing my sort of expeditionary land forces around, would be we can deploy an armor division and we can keep it at three brigades. So you probably need about three regular brigades and three reserve brigades to make sure you can sustain it in times of a long-term conflict. You can keep it at a good strength for a period. And therefore, you do need probably you do need tanks for that and those things. You need a properly constituted armor division. But I sit there and go, okay, right then. So what's our theater entry force? Well, you need the Royal Marines to secure a landing area to get that armor division there if you're going to take them anywhere else. But the odds are, if the Royal Marines are going anywhere, it's going to be a northern barrier, in which case, if they reinforce an area, then you need a strike brigade style package. Again, the British Army built a strike brigade and they didn't just go, right then, we're going to call it the same thing as we're calling the Americans. We're not going to buy the Striker, though, vehicle. We're going to go buy other things and all sort of things. They're going, okay, you're basically trying to rebuild a British version of a Striker brigade, but not call it, but not calling it that, not actually involving Striker. Okay, fine, that makes sense. Okay, but all right. What are they going to do? Where are you going to rapidly deploy them and who are you going to rapidly deploy them through? It's going to have to be, if they're going to be deployed anywhere, they're going to be the second brigade going in behind the Marines, aren't they? So if we did do Falklands 2, it would be Royal Marines and it would be a strike brigade. And it would probably be a 16th Air Assault Brigade as well, popping along.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, well, as the Falkland showed, you don't need 120,000 people to pull off something like the size of the Falklands. You probably need the overall size to be able to provide your core spear tip elements, but that's really as far as you really need to go. Yeah, it's just one of those things where I look at it and I go, okay, fine. 120,000 men, as I said, in the army, you can do X, but you still need the Navy, et cetera, et cetera. And it's going to cost a lot of money. It might be a good idea to have, but you know, we're not going to save Ukraine single-handed with 120,000 men. Whereas if you had 120,000 men in the Royal Navy, think of how many ships you could crew with that. Because we've currently got 35,000 odd active personnel, something like that, and a few thousand more in reserve. So if we had a 120,000 man strong Navy, it's exactly the same, roughly exactly the same wage bill as 120,000 strong army. But, well, when you consider what we do with just under 35,000 men, so you double that up to 70, double that up again to 105. So we'd be talking about a Navy roughly 3.5 times as strong manpower-wise as exists currently.
So probably sustain about 4 times as much equipment, because once you get through the base levels of the things you need to sustain with that much equipment, you could probably maintain a fleet 4 times as strong as we currently have.
Yeah, and I would say, to be honest, given that the Navy has some manning issues at the moment, even if we reduce it from 3.5 to 3 times, you know, even a Navy 3 times as strong as it is at the moment, just roughly speaking, not including the logistics elements, etc., which we obviously do to take account for, but just looking at the big ticket assets, that would be 6 aircraft carriers. That would be probably, with economies of scale, two dozen anti-aircraft warfare destroyers, probably in the region of 3 to 4 dozen frigates. You know, at that point, when you're tooling around with 80 plus major surface combatants and 6 carriers, that actually would make the Royal Navy the second most powerful Navy on the planet by a considerable margin. You know, yes, the Chinese Navy is growing quite considerably, but that force, not including OPVs, submarines, and the RFA, that force, assuming it's all properly equipped, would be a bit more powerful than the current Chinese Navy. And so the only thing that would be bigger would be the US Navy. And, you know, we could exert an awful lot more power and presence and influence in the world with the second largest navy on the planet than what the 15th largest army.
Yes. Actually, no, sorry, I'm just mentally thinking Britain having the second largest navy in the world. Then we only need one good storm and we would be the largest.
Well, unfortunately, there's no admiral. They're currently named Halsey in the US and US Navy service. So we'd have to wait a little bit on that one.
But there is an admiral named Henderson, or at least soon to be one.
Mm-hmm.
From, I hear, the same family. Oh, yes. We can all be slightly worried. No one take this the wrong way in terms of predicting history, but there is a certain... I know I've talked mostly about Reginald Henderson, who was Third Sea Lord prior to World War II, but there does seem to be a small pattern in history that does emerge, that when you find a Henderson is getting to senior ranks in the Royal Navy, big wars tend to happen. I'm not sure what it is about that family.
Oh. They're like our that gopher or groundhog in the States that's used to predict spring. They're our version of that. It's like there's probably an equation written deep into the fabric of the universe that if Henderson and Royal Navy equals true, then execute large war.exe.
Oh, it's fun. Mm-hmm. So, also, one thing we can talk about on Bill Trumps, and we can do this as interlude before our next one, which is going next part of this, which is going to be us basically talking about the Americans and some more stuff which has come out on the Light Destroyer. We can talk about our Canada trip because we've got some rough dates for people.
Yes,
we are going to be in Canada from the 3rd to the 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Although, due to a booking snafu, it seems I'm going to be there till the 12th. Just don't tell my family I've got an extra day. Me and Drac are going to be together in Hamilton and in Halifax.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go off to see Texas.
Hopefully, yes. So, yeah, 3rd, we're in... theoretically landing in Canada I'm landing in Canada on the 3rd. I think you're landing a day or two earlier than that.
I'm landing on the 2nd.
So yeah, so you're landing on the 2nd. I'm landing on the 3rd. We're then in Toronto, or more particularly in Hamilton, around HMCS Hyder until Tuesday the 7th, which is when we both disappear off to Halifax. So
yeah,
then,
you need to tell me what flight you're booked on because I need to book on it.
Yeah,
I booked the hotels, but not the flights.
Hopefully, because of the way all the time zones etc. work out, that would basically be almost a 0 hours flight, daytime wise. So yeah, we're in Halifax Tuesday the 7th, Wednesday the 8th. Then I'm off down to Texas on the 9th, Thursday the 9th, and then I come back on the 11th and head home. And Dr. Clark stays in Halifax until the 10th, and then we're coming back for 2 or 3 days in Toronto.
I'm actually also leaving on the 9th. Leaving the evening of the 9th Halifax, and I'm going back to Hamilton because I'm going back to wander around in that area and see a lot of... and at some points, I am supposed to be bumping into... my Canadian family relatives are going to be descending on me for a day. And I had thought you might... I wasn't quite sure how it worked out, so I had it worked out that I would get back to Hamilton definitely before you got to... you came back from Texas.
Yes.
So you would not have to deal with the full en masse clans of Canadian relatives all... arriving and swarming you and going, hello, you're Alex's friend, hello. I was going to actually, my theory was if they did arrive when you were there, I was going to give them name tags Because there is
Clark,
about
not Dr. Clark.
there are conversations between the aunts going on. There might be about 90 people coming to see me at one point. Oh, I love it when the aunt when the aunts get involved. It's quite scary. But no, it's going to be fun. Anyway, that's we will be announcing more details as we go along, as we put them together, as the various things get organized, so people know. The one thing I can definitely say is that we are booked in for, well, I'm booked in to do some things on my own on Haida on the 3rd. I get this is why I'm getting there early, because I get a morning on Haida, just me wandering around HMCS Haida, which I'm really looking forward to. And no, it's not open to public at all that day. And then we're going to be doing some more filming on the 4th. So and that's going to be me and Drac filming together and doing some things together. So that's going to be the point at which we're going to be waving. And there should be something in the evening. There is about 3 different options, because there are the friends of HMCS Haida who I'm talking with, the HMCS Haida themselves, the Navy League of Canada. Well, they're not called that anymore, but that's what they were. And McMaster University are all trying to talk about trying to cram in events for both me and Drac to be there talking to people. Well, basically, they're using the old trick of, well, we should we'll bring in the guy who's the academic. And yes, so we can say we are putting on an academic lecture because he's got the title. And we'll also bring in his mate who's just as good as him, but just
academic title. It's just Bachelor of Engineering.
Yes, that's true. Oh, and that just confuses historical societies. Bachelor of Engineering doesn't compute. We know
this. Engineering honours. I'll have to check my certificate. I haven't looked at that thing in about 15 years.
Yeah, just bring it with you and just go, I'm honours.
Mm.
I actually got my degree. I did. Engineers do not just spring from the earth fully formed like dwarves. We are real people too. I kid you not. Sometimes it's working as the historian in an engineering department and occasionally teaching engineering history. And so I never really realized it was quite this weird until I did that. And then moving between those two worlds and going, the engineers don't believe the historians have degrees. The historians don't believe the engineers have degrees. And it's quite funny when you wander through going, yes, I am the only one accepted by both of you.
Mm-hmm.
I am the John Major of this scenario.
Oh, dear.
But no, it's going to be fun.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
So do we have something to talk about to wrap up this episode?
Well, we do have, as I said, it's the Light Destroyer. There is more stuff coming out about the Light Destroyer program.
Let's have a look at that then. What's the story on this?
Well, the CNO has made some more announcements on Light Destroyer, and basically he's put forward that the Light Destroyer is going to be critical for interfacing with the Light Amphibious Warfare Project. Yes, and that it's been integrated into, and I will send you the link into the new Navy Light Amphibious Warfare Warship and the Congressional Research Service's report. And apparently, the Light Destroyer, one of its primary jobs, is going to be alongside the new frigate to escort and support the Light Amphibious Warfare ship. There you go.
What? I feel like that poor old cassette.
This is the document I've sent you the copy link to the document which was attached to the announcement, which had that little quote in. I presume the quote is in there somewhere, but I haven't actually managed to find it. Otherwise, they've made up an entire quote they've attached to another document.
Yeah, as I say, I'm like, I think I'm at this point, I'm that Futurama cassette robot that just has what on the cassette tape that just has to keep being inserted. For flip's sake.
The idea is they're building a light naval force.
So they're going to have a full-size navy, and then they're going to have baby's first navy that operates alongside them, which presumably what, they're going to crew with cadets?
Well, no, here's what I think. That I think what it has is the US Navy has finally admitted that their origins are really the Continental Army. And they've decided what they need is a heavy division and light divisions like the current US Army has. So they want the heavy division, which is their carriers, and their light divisions are their new light forces.
Navies don't work that way, people.
That's the only reason I can see for them keep attaching light to everything. And also, I am just waiting for someone to say in Congress, well, this is a destroyer and this is a destroyer, but this costs about half the price of this one on paper, so we'll just buy more of these. And you go, no, that's a light destroyer. We're not quite sure what they were on when they produced that, but basically it's an air warfare frigate.
So you're building targets is what you're building.
Hey, don't be quite that cruel. I'm sure they'll be very fast, because that's the other criteria coming through in all their light warships. They have to be fast, and that works so well with the LCS, didn't it?
Yeah, because, you know, being able to go at 40 knots really, really makes you able to outrun a hypersonic missile going, I don't know, 4,000. Yes, this will work.
Mm.
Never mind the fact you're basically going to be 50% engine by volume, and therefore you'll be able to land like 6 Marines.
And
maybe all this makes sense with that, you know, this whole thing they had a year or two ago where they were announced they were reconfiguring the US Marines and dropping all the tanks and the heavy equipment. Maybe this is all part of some grand, if this is all part of the grand plan, now that the average amphibious warfare vessel is going to be really, really fast, but can carry probably the equivalent of a school bus's worth of Marines and nothing heavier. So you can't.
And probably probably wouldn't be able to carry a school bus either.
No, so you can't have the actual heavy equipment because you won't have any ships capable of carrying the heavy equipment. So we're just going to, very circular logic.
Oh, they certainly explain why they are cancelling the San Antonios and pretty much all the heavy. They're getting rid of all the heavy lift stuff. I'm just watching them and I'm going, right then. The one thing I was kind of interested in over the years, I thought it was badly executed, but it's quite an interesting idea, was they said, I think they were the Point class, which were these big, basically mobile floating docks. And I'm not talking as in a floating dry dock.
This is a mobile offshore base idea.
Yeah. And I actually thought, you know what, that actually makes sense for some things, because basically you can bring alongside a conventional merchant ship, offload it, and put it into connectors that can take it ashore. So if you don't have a port ashore, that's fine. And you don't have to be in the place where the port is. You can be offshore, nice and out of the people's range. Now, it's not something I would do against a peer threat, up threat with them, i.e. China. But if I was operating off the coast of Africa or something like that, I'd consider that.
Okay.
You know, if I was doing a counterinsurgency operation, et cetera, that would be a great way to protect my logistics. The logistics hub is off the other, is off the coast.
Let's try and put this into small words so that they can understand. Okay. Yes. A large navy.
Please note, we're saying it's not small words for Americans to understand. Americans do understand large words. We're fairly sure the US and the US Admiralty of the Admirals of the US Navy who are writing these things don't.
Or possibly the politicians are making them write it.
Yes, that's the other option.
And to be honest, this to a certain extent applies to a lot of other large.
Oh, am I the only one who's waiting for the British to start announcing the new light generation warships?
Because that's called a Type 32.
Yes.
You know, which at this rate is going to be a rowboat with a very angry Marine on the front. But
to be fair, that'd be quite scary.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, okay.
Especially if you told him he didn't have any alcohol.
Let's put it this way, okay. Yes, large navies have historically had a significant contingent of light forces, the Royal Navy being the most recent example that isn't the US Navy. So you've got, you know, Royal Navy, 19th century, US Navy, World War II, Royal Navy, World War II, for that matter, as well. However,
Royal Canadian Navy in World War II, yeah, they were pretty much entirely light forces.
Yeah. However, the light forces are either mono-mission spec in World War II, you know, their anti-submarine warfare assets, which are built because it is impossible to build the full-sized ones you actually want in enough numbers. That's the key thing. Same thing, escort carriers, light carriers, etc. Yep, they all existed in World War II because they couldn't build fleet carriers fast enough or in large enough numbers because they needed them now. The industry to build sufficient fleet carriers was there. The industry to build sufficient sloops and sufficient destroyers was there if you'd started in 1932. But they were starting in 1939, 1941. They didn't have the time, so they had to churn out the small, cheap stuff really quickly. Look what happened to that small, cheap stuff as soon as the war ended. Pretty much almost all of it went into mothballs, to scrap, or was given to very small navies that you're allied with who wanted to have something to fly a flag from. The vast, vast, vast majority of river-class, various flavors of destroyer, escort carriers, flowers, etc., the vast majority of that stuff was not in the US Navy or Royal Navy inventories within 5 years of the end of World War II, because it's not optimal. It's not optimal. It's not particularly efficient manpower-wise. They get outdated very quickly because they've got minimal room for expansion, and they're not credible threats to a peer opponent. And yes, it's a world war, but let's face it, the Kriegsmarine was never a peer opponent to any large allied navy. Admittedly, there were only two large allied navies, Royal Navy and the US Navy, but the Kriegsmarine were not a peer threat. They had a slightly disproportionate threat in their submarine arm. But even then, the Royal Navy and the US Navy, despite having submarine arms that were not their main thrust of attack, had comparable or larger submarine arms to the Kriegsmarine. And the Kriegsmarine's destroyer, cruiser, battleship, and non-existent carrier arms were pathetically tiny. So that's...
Well, let's be honest, the destroyers started out World War II with 22 ships, and by the time Narvik was over, we're down to 11.
Yeah, so that's the background for the slightly more modern use of small warships. You know, you use them because... You build them because you don't have a choice. Because it's wartime. And
let's be honest, there's the reality is, if we can consider Japan,
mm-hmm,
who didn't build enough in many ways because they made the choice that they weren't going to build it because they didn't think they could compete on the mass of ships.
Yes.
So they tried to keep building quality, and mm-hmm, they didn't ever had enough ships.
No, but at the same time, Japan did hold out. It did take 3 or 4 years to grind them down.
Yeah.
If Japan had had slightly more, but much less capable, more fragile ships, the whole thing would have been done and dusted a lot sooner. It's one of the key elements of naval history. If you're the smaller power, don't waste your money trying to compete with the larger navies by having small cheap ships, because the other navies can build bigger and more expensive ships and more of them. But regardless,
they can build enough small ships that they can swarm you.
Yes. And the other example, as I say, is the 19th century Royal Navy, which, yes, was a peacetime navy, and yes, had large numbers of small craft, sloops, corvettes, gunboats, etc. But what were they using them for? They were using them for second and third line duties, for colonial duties, showing the flag, popping around to various ports and just saying, hello, here's a white ensign, you know what's behind us if you annoy us, all of that kind of, lots of peacetime and low-level conflict duties. The Royal Navy did not take 19th century gunboats, corvettes, and sloops into actual wars. The closest you come to that is probably the Crimean War. And even then, that was largely in the Black Sea, and largely because the Russians had quite conveniently scuttled the vast, vast, vast majority of their navy in Sevastopol. So you might as well use the small ships to just patrol up and down the coast and look into things, because there's nothing that's going to come to stop them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they didn't use them in the Baltic, where the Russians might still have sailed. The only things they were planning to use in the Baltic that are on the scale of small ships were things like bomb vessels and specially built assault gunboats, which were going to be used under the protection of a much larger fleet for a very specific thing, which was going to be an attack on Kronstadt, but the war came to an end before that finally came to fruition. But when you look at what the Royal Navy was doing in the run-up to, say, World War One, during the Anglo-German naval arms race, when it was becoming very apparent that there may actually be a peer-on-peer conflict, and that's what they were preparing for, they weren't building gunboats anymore. They weren't building sloops and corvettes anymore. They built a couple of river gunboats for specific campaign purposes. But by and large, all production of that kind of light warships pretty much ceases in the 1900s. And what they're building, fleet destroyers, they're building cruisers of various flavors, and they're building capital ships, because those are the things you use to fight a peer war. So, winding all that forward to today, US Navy, are you currently at war with a reasonably threatening opponent, i.e. Kriegsmarine or Regiemarine equivalent? No, right. So you don't need to crash build a Bogue Independence insert variant of destroyer escort equivalent here. You know, you don't need to build those because you're not at war. Okay, good. So that whole argument from World War II is out the window. Yes, you are.
Oh, and I've heard that someone's planning on calling them the Fletcher class.
Oh dear.
The light destroyers.
That kind of dishonors them, considering the Fletchers were big, heavy destroyers, but never mind.
Yeah, let's be honest, the Fletchers were definitely not light destroyers.
Not for the time, no. So, okay, so yeah, your argument from World War II is out the window. So what about your argument from the 19th century? Okay, yes, the US Navy is currently the global hegemon navy. It's occupying the same spot the Royal Navy was. What exactly is the US Navy preparing for? Is this the 1990s when you can go and, you know, shoot up random Somalians or something? No. We're in the 2020s, and realistically, as we've said many times before on bilge pumps and as lots of other people pointed out, realistically, this is the time when the big Western navies need to rearm and rebuild their forces with an eye to peer or near-peer opponent conflict. What does history say the global hegemon does when a challenge to its power is arising, like say China? You build your big, serious surface combatants. And even in the interwar period, during the interwar period, the Royal Navy was quite happy to go toodling along building 1300 to 1500 ton, usually 1300 to 1400 ton letter name destroyers. But when in 1935 it looked like things were going to get serious and they might actually have to fight somebody like Germany or Italy, they started building the tribals, they started building the JKLMNNs, they built big fleet destroyers. They abandoned the interwar Leander, Arethusa, York-style diminutive cruisers, and they started building, well, they were already building towns, but they started looking at building bigger, over 10,000-ton cruiser, 6-inch cruisers. Sorry, that's the bell. Don't know what that is for. And they started looking at bigger 8-inch cruisers as well.
It's what you do. You start building these things because you need them. If you're looking at it, if you look at the Royal Navy in the run-up to World War II, they're sort of the light cruiser level is moving to the Crown Colony, and the Edinburghs are sort of moving up, and they're sort of going, right then. And when I talk about light cruiser, I mean Arethusa's levels is moving up to the Crown Colony. Kind of like there's the interesting ARA La Argentina, which is that triple turret version Arethusa. Sort of a stepping stone to, nine-gun, six-inch light cruiser is a good idea. And then they sort of, the Royal Navy's going, right then, we need bigger cruisers. You can almost consider the King George V's a stepping stone idea to capital ships, because they are having 14-inch guns, and everyone in the Royal Navy is going, why? Okay, well, they'll do for something to replace the battle cruisers, perhaps in a sort of fast fast battleship role, and then we'll build something heavier, lions coming up and all the other stuff. You build these ships, and if you look again at carriers, they're getting bigger and bigger, and the Royal Navy is working towards, already working on plans. But it's basically what it could be basically described as an armored hangar carrier with the hangar and flight deck setup of Ark Royal, which is what their ultimate aim is at that point in the late 1938-39. That's the carrier they want to build. That's the carrier they really want to build when they have a war and when they think there's going to be a war. They're not looking at it going, you know what we need to do is churn out tons of little carriers, because when they churn out the tons of little carriers, that's A, because they don't have enough big carriers to go around, but also because what do they not have? They don't have the long-range land-based aircraft they thought they were going to have, and everyone presumed to be part of any anti-submarine warfare doctrine, because all those aircraft are being concentrated on other missions, mainly heavy bombing and blowing up parts of Germany. It happens. But you end up needing to fill in holes, and that's what you build these light mission ships for. Yeah. Monopurpose, monomission ships. Anything good?
No, just a couple of security cameras.
Ah, fun.
So, yeah. It boggles my mind that for some reason, some people are still running on the idea that they can reinvent the wheel, and their genius idea of reinventing the wheel appears to be a heptagon where none of the sides are actually the same length.
I don't know. The thing is, everyone wants to believe they're smarter than previous generations. It's always the case. You always want to believe because you have better technology, you're smarter. And that doesn't necessarily mean the way it can be the case. Better technology does not equal smarter.
No, in fact, it usually means dumber, because your ancestors had to survive without that technology. You know, a guy who made it to age 60 or 70 in the 14th century or in the 1st century or in the 10th century BC, to be honest, was probably a heck of a lot more practically smart than most people at least in the Western world are, because they had most of the regular concerns that we have, except they also had to worry about freezing to death, starving to death, being attacked by random raiders, etc., etc., and figure out how to survive all of that. And let's not get stuck down on that stupid trope of everybody died at age 30. You know, statistics are a thing, but yes, when you examine those statistics, you find out the average mortality age is massively skewed by the fact there was a huge amount of infant mortality. If you actually made it to adulthood prior to the Industrial Revolution, you had a pretty decent chance of reaching at least your mid-60s. And, you know, people who were in their 80s weren't uncommon. People who reached even 90 or 100, okay, they were a bit rare, but let's face it, they're not exactly common these days either. Human life expectancy, yes, with modern medicine, etc., has increased. But one, it's not increased by as much as you think. And two, it's increased in significant part when you're comparing it to 19th century statistics over a historical dip in life expectancy that was caused by the Industrial Revolution and everybody concluding that packing everybody into tight housing in the middle of cities full of smog and all sorts of other chemicals was a good idea, which, you know, suddenly, you know, you can actually see in the 19th century, broadly speaking, at least in the so-called developed nations, overall life expectancy went down and overall mortality went up, even though all the technology was improving. But yeah.
You know, the example I tend to give is William Marshall, who was, of course, the first Earl of Pembroke and lived.
And my distant ancestor.
Yeah, he lived to 72 and he died in 1219.
Lived to 72 whilst actively fighting in melee combat in multiple major battles, including one a few years before his death, where they went off to find him in a blacksmith shop having the helmet bashed off of his head because it had been hit so hard it had bent in a way he couldn't get it off.
Yes. You know, you sort of go, well, the nicest way, what would his part, imagine his response to someone saying, you know what, we have one of the largest, most well-funded militaries in the world. We're going to build a new generation of light destroyer.
He'd probably turn around and say, yes, I met a knight who wanted to save money by having light armor a few decades ago. I think he ended up full of holes on some battlefield in France.
I think I killed him would probably be his response. Yes. He had light armor. I had a heavy hammer.
Mm. And soon he was light on both armor and life.
And I was rich in both.
Mm. Yes, so, it was one of the ways he made a lot of money, to be fair.
Yeah, he was very successful at fighting wars. There was a reason he was the Marshal.
Yes. Well, that's the thing people have got to remember. He wasn't originally called Marshal. He's William Marshal because he was William the Marshal.
Mm.
To the point that even when we were having what technically could be classified as the first English Civil War with the whole Barons' Rebellion against Prince John, given the fact that the Barons were a little bit annoyed with John, and well, he was king at that point, I guess. And yeah. John was not exactly a particularly reasonable person at the best of times.
Mm-hmm.
Marshall was the only one that both sides actually trusted.
When the French invaded, he commanded the troops which kicked the French out.
Yep, Battle of Lincoln.
Basically, he said in the nicest way, I don't care about your arguments. The French aren't coming into my country and you'll either follow me or I will go and beat them myself.
Yeah.
And we're all worried about looking like wusses compared to him.
And when everyone looked around to continue the argument with the geriatric old granddad in shiny armour, they discovered he'd already hightailed it off towards Lincoln Cathedral to start stabbing people.
Yes!
At which point it's like, do you want to be shown up as being left behind when the OAPs went to war? And everyone kind of just follows.
It's a way of forming an army. You will form up in line. Why? Because otherwise the OAPs are going to win this battle without you. It's the French.
To be fair, you know, get something done before the OAPs come and do it in a far more deadly fashion has been a good theme in British history for a fairly long period of time.
This is another reason why I say be very, very afraid of the Home Guard in the UK. Mm. There is a long tradition of making fun of them thanks to the Dad's Army comedy series, which is excellent. But honestly, the stories I hear back from people who are in the Home Guard, etc., they don't sound like they were planning on playing cricket in a nice way.
No, well, as I've said before on that particular subject, the people forget that, yes, the people in the Home Guard were in the Home Guard because they were too old to fight in the new war. When was the new war being fought? Early 1940s, pretty much. Late 39. So what happens? Okay, let's wind back. So let's say they're going to be exempt from military service from the late 40s, early 50s, bit older than that.
Mm.
Okay, so if you're, let's say you're 50, how old would you have been in 1914?
Mm.
Early 20s.
You'd been about 25.
Yep. So basically, the Home Guard was largely made up of the people who were rank and file in World War One, with all the trauma that induced.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were told, right, guys, yeah, all that horrific fighting you saw against the Germans, you're now the last line of defense against the same people, only this time they're even nastier. We're potentially fighting on British soil, and your families are about 2 miles behind the lines. Just how nasty do you think they were going to get?
Yeah. In nicest way, I think if you were a German and taken prisoner, you'd found yourself a regular unit.
Yeah, I mean, as I said before, I've been through the archives looking at various bits of coastal defence plan for theoretical German invasions. And to be honest, the vast, vast, vast majority of the correspondence tends to be the professional naval officers and the professional army officers coming up with some very nice, neat plan for defence and withdrawal, etc. And then some Home Guard officer chipping in, basically going, yes, but what if we made it 16 times more evil and horrific for the other side? Which is usually followed by the correspondence equivalent in very, very fine language from the professional officers going, who is this man? Why is he off his medication? And then who let him into the planning room? Also,
and the thing,
whichever service is writing this is also, the other service can try and dissuade him because we don't want to go anywhere near him because he might bite.
And you also have to remember, again, we're watching currently in Ukraine. We've been seeing what farmers with tractors can get up to. Again, a lot of the Home Guard in the county areas were farmers with access to equipment. And builders with access to equipment. Yes, it wasn't the same we have today, but it was still a lot of equipment. And if you ever want a good tour of the UK, is to go what's Ram called my friend who organized it calls it the improvised pillbox tour of the UK. These pillboxes do not appear on any official maps because no one in central officialdom actually had them constructed. But the local Home Guard unit would go, we need a pillbox to defend this position. We do. And can you imagine what a pillbox built by builders and farmers who had served in World War One, had seen the horrors of that, looks like?
Mm-hmm.
It is not something any military unit would want to try and take. It is a small fortress. And they are positioned in places. If you go through the UK, you can find them. And they usually are watching things like bridges and curves in the road where you have to curve around. They are not nice places to try and take out. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone, for listening. I think we've probably worn your head off. As I said, next week there won't be a bilge pumps. So it'll be delayed. And then it'll be me and Jamie organising something the week after that.
Yeah.
It's all right. Thank you very much for watching, listening. We hope you enjoyed. And And those of you in America, if you are going to be bumping into Drac, make sure to say hi to him from me.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, see you all later.
See you all.
Bye.
Welcome to the Bilge Pumps, where a bunch of naval geeks spout